Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today my guest is Glenn Carroll, a visual artist who got involved in nuclear issues when the Chernobyl meltdown in Russia inspired her to join efforts to stop Vogtle 1 and 2 nuclear reactors in Georgia. She is the coordinator of Nuclear Watch South, headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, and has been committed to grassroots direct action for 25 years. With a small group of volunteers, she led Nuclear Watch South to shut the research reactor at Georgia Tech campus in downtown Atlanta, where the Olympic athletes were to be housed. Nuclear Watch South is at the forefront of resistance to two nuclear reactors at Vogtle and has a decade-long legal intervention in opposition to MOX plutonium reactor fuel remanufactured from nuclear weapons. Glenn is a 2008 recipient of the Tides Foundation Jane Bagley Lehman Award. She joins me now on the line. Glenn Carroll, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you, Helen.
That's a pleasure, Glenn. So you're really you're a visual artist. What happened to you? All those years ago when Chernobyl melted down. What happened to you emotionally, psychologically?
Well, I was actually imposed upon by a friend. I was trapped on a raft in the middle of the river, and he just kept talking about nuclear energy.
Yeah.
And I was just bored to tears. But after a couple of hours, it just really clicked, you know, that plutonium is made in a reactor, that there's such a vast quantity of radioactivity in there that if anything goes wrong, it's going to be a new experience for our planet. And that our government was not only not protecting us from this, but they were doing it. So I kind of filed that away. I got a bumper sticker. I started chatting up some friends in college and art school. And they said, well, you like electricity, don't you? And I couldn't argue with them. And then Three Mile Island happened. But, you know, they didn't know that it was a meltdown. So I was still in La La Land. But when I hit the airport in Montego Bay, Jamaica. And this was actually before the world knew, but I heard a Rastaman in the airport say, Yaman, there's been a meltdown in Russia. Well, this was the onset of my most exotic vacation of my life, and I was on pins and needles the whole time. Every time it rained, when some Jamaicans caught a fish and then, you know, brought it to us to eat, I just was really uneasy. And I did a painting about the radioactive reindeer, and that worked. People were interested in that. And I did some more paintings. I mapped all the reactors and painted a map of where all the reactors were. And then I saw a phone number to a group, and I'd never gotten involved in anything like this before, and I called them up, and I said, well, can I help you out? You know, maybe I could help you do your newsletter or draw some pictures. Maybe we could design posters. And that was how I started. But it was not very long before I realized that policy is a creative medium. And I got deeper and deeper into, you know, what are we going to do? You know, we really have got a thorny issue that human beings have never figured out before. And it's going to take, you know, the best and brightest of us to figure this out. So my artwork has suffered over the last 25 years in that my studio is full of paper about nuclear, and it's really hard to sit down and make work. But I do feel like it will take creativity to meet these challenges that haven't been solved. And so I'm happy to, it's made me very happy to do this work. It's made me very happy to meet really fine examples of human beings who reach way out of themselves to figure this out. So I got to meet you.
Yes, I think I find that too. I find that if I stop doing this work, I get really depressed. I even have to take antidepressants. I get so depressed. And I find that the sort of path to psychological well-being, if you will, and health, is to get really involved and spend my life and most of my energy trying to save the planet. And it actually makes me feel very joyful, and I meet people like you, you see, too. But we need to get back to this blasted situation that you're facing in southern Georgia. I'm just trying to draw up the chronology of the nuclear power plant in Georgia. So would you like, before I find it on the web now, would you like to start right at the beginning, Glenn Carroll, of how this blasted Vogel reactor situation occurred? What reactors are there now? What are they planning in the future? The corruption, the misuse of funding, the public funding that goes into these really evil, monstrous machines. Start right at the beginning, Glenn Carroll.
Now, you're talking about going back to 1969.
Yes.
Okay. And were you looking for that on our website?
Yeah, I'm just trying to find it now.
So, in 1969, Georgia Power wanted to jump on the bandwagon to build nuclear reactors. And, of course, we know that two things had to go down historically for any utility to get into this game. Number one, the government promised to pick up that problematic radioactive waste. And when the insurance companies would not insure nuclear reactors, the government said, we'll cap the liability, and any mess you make that costs more than $10 billion, the taxpayers will take care of it. And then the utilities got on the bandwagon, and Georgia Power was right there. And they proposed to build four reactors at Vogel for $600 million. And they breezed through that in 6 months and went bankrupt. Then we have a public service commission here that's really been helpful to Georgia Power to help them do whatever nefarious ideas they have, no matter how ill thought out.
Well, what is the public service? I don't understand what the Georgia Public Service is.
Public Service Commission is a body of five people that are elected to six-year terms.
By whom?
By the people of the state of Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
We've always been disappointed in their votes. There hasn't been a vote that went against Georgia Power in its history. Sometimes we get two votes. Sometimes we get one vote. Sometimes we think somebody draws a straw and says, I'll vote against it, so they won't think we're, you know, up to something.
Well, how come, what I don't understand is, you know, when I go to Georgia, they say Georgia Power runs the whole state. I don't understand why they're so powerful. Where do they get, I mean, they're called Georgia Power, right, but, you know, they generate electricity. But how come they're so politically powerful, Glenn Carroll?
Well, I don't know. We had a recent example. You know, now I came in late. By the time I came into Chernobyl, the first generation of reactors was by and large built in this country. We were some of the last to come online in the late 80s. And it had been a hell of a fight all over the country. And one of the ideas that had been put out there, and you probably can speak more to this than I can, Helen, was this quip. Construction work in progress, and the idea that it was so expensive to build these things and it took so long to add them to the grid where you could start charging for the electricity that they came up with this plan that customers should pay for it before it's built. And that was pretty much found unlawful throughout the country, and I don't quite know how the campaigns went, but Georgia also did not do that. But this time, and I lived this, two or three years ago, Georgia Power had one lobbyist for every three legislators in our state legislature.
Well, where do they get their money from to pay for their lobbyists?
Well, the Public Service Commission gives them rates which ensure a 12% profit.
So the people...
And here lately, they officially put it down on paper that there would be automatic rate increases to ensure a 12% profit.
So the people of Georgia are funding the Southern Georgia Power Company. They fund it to provide lobbyists to lobby the elected officials to build nuclear power plants to poison the people of Georgia.
Yep. And they're lobbying Washington. I mean, you know, to go back to this chronology, they almost went bankrupt 6 months in. They blew through the $600 million they said they could build four reactors for, and how any sober-minded person agreed with this is unknown.
So when did they go bankrupt? What year?
It was 1971. And they strong-armed all the little electric municipal corporations and all the little co-ops all over the state were pretty much forced to buy shares in Vogtle. And they would, you know, share the power. Because one of the things that was going on over the 20-year saga of building, they went from four reactor project to two. And it took 20 years to build. And
to build
the final tally was something in the order of $6.9 billion up from the $600 million they said they could build four reactors for. And meanwhile, my forebears, the group I joined, they produced periodically studies that showed that it would be cheaper to abandon the plant, absorb the cost, and go forward with renewables. And that was just ignored. So the long and the short of it is, and it took me a little while to figure this out, Southern Company is obsessed. They never gave up on the four plants, the four reactors. And we were just talking about lobbying, right? Well, they spent the 15, 20-year interval between finishing the two and getting started on the two that just got licensed. They've been up in Washington lobbying. They were there when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission went from the two-step licensing, so you had a chance to check out the reactor you built before you switched it on. They were there when that changed to one-step licensing. They were there when Dick Cheney made his secret backdoor energy plan. And to me, the biggest scandal of all is they put a Federal Reserve Bank officer in place from 2002 to 2010 to shepherd these loan guarantees. And so they've just really been working a program to make sure they finish their four-reactor vision.
Well, now, wait a minute.
And I kind of have my hat off to them for focusing on it.
I don't. I think they're evil. I think they're absolutely evil. So they built two reactors in Georgia. A, where are they located? And B, when were those two reactors completed? Glenn Carroll.
The first two.
Yeah.
When were they completed?
Yes.
They are in Burke County, which is one of the largest land area counties and one of the most sparsely populated and one of the poorest counties in Georgia. It's very near Augusta, which is known to people for the Masters Golf Tournament is in Augusta.
For the what tournament?
The Masters Golf
Tournament.
The Masters
Golf Tournament, yes.
So now Augusta is on the Savannah River.
Yeah.
Savannah is a couple of hours downstream. It's a port city. Augusta is up. It's also very near the Savannah Riverside Nuclear Weapons Reservation.
Yeah.
And on a clear day, you can see the cooling towers of Vogtle across the river from Savannah Riverside. And even our Nuclear Regulatory Commission judges have commented on the high concentration of radiation in this region. We're having a historic drought. I want to make sure that's understood, because one of the things that we've really studied on meeting the challenge of these new reactors all over is the water consumption is incredibly high for these reactors. And we feel that we're already drawing all that the river can handle. Okay, but still, the you asked, the first two reactors came online in, I think, 86 and 87.
1986.
And, of course, Chernobyl happened in 86.
So 1986 and 87. What size are they? Are they 1,000 megawatt reactors, these two reactors?
Yes, a little bit more, about 1,200 megawatts.
And I want you to describe the community in which they're located sociologically, Glen Carroll, please, in Burke County.
Well, it's, like I said, it's very rural, very poor, and it's a large county. So the county seat is not as close to the reactors as the rural black community. And they live in this part of the community. It's called Shell Bluff. And out there, the roads aren't paved. There's no grocery stores. There's a little convenience store where you can buy gasoline. And one of the most heart-wrenching things I heard when the BBC interviewed members of the community and asked them about the economic benefits, and they said, look around you. Our roads aren't paved. We don't have a grocery store. Do you see a hospital or a fire station? They said, when we have an emergency out here, it takes 45 minutes for an ambulance to get here.
Now, they're mostly African-Americans, right? And what size is the population at Shell Bluff, just next to the reactor?
Oh, gosh. That would be an interesting thing to look up. I mean, we've got some towns in Georgia that have population 50. It's low. Let me see if I can find that.
It's larger than that. Now, I read a report recently that almost every family, this is anecdotal evidence, but that almost every family has relatives or friends who've died of cancer in that community in the last, 20 years, yeah.
I mean, they did not have this experience. Shell Bluff, I'm getting population 13,000.
13,000, well, that's large.
Black population is 7,000.
7,000, so it's a majority of African Americans. So what do you know about the cancer incidence?
This is for the whole county, actually. I don't think it's giving me just Shell Bluff.
All right.
I think the whole county has 13,000 people.
So what do you know about the cancer incidence, Glen Carroll, in this community just next to these two Vogel reactors that have been operating since 86, 87?
Well, I mean, not only do very basic studies that just look at public health data find a significant increase in cancer, but what is the most compelling of all is meeting the people who say, we never had cancer, and now every single one of our families has people with cancer, and our cemetery is filling up with young people.
Oh, dear.
Who are dying. So, it's just heartbreaking. You see them on the news, and they say, well, we're not saying it's the nuclear reactors, but what is it? Is it the air? Is it the water? Is it our food?
And tell me,
we know that the reactors affect.
Is the health commission doing an epidemiological study of this community, Glen Carroll?
Well, that was something that really angered me. We went to the last meeting of the NRC and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and Southern Company, and Atlanta is a headquarters for Region 2. So they were meeting here in Atlanta, and it was the day before the licenses were given, and it was a pretty shameful experience. All members of the public were shuttled to a secondary room, so they didn't even let us in to the main hearing room. But a few of us went in there to address them, and it was the atmosphere in there was giddy. It really was unseemly for all these men in suits. There were three women in there. One was a reporter. One woman was sitting at the table. It was all men. And the head of Region 2 addressed Reverend Willie Tomlin, who lives in Shell Bluff, and he spoke of the cancer that's happening, and he spoke of a National Academy of Sciences study that's been commissioned by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as if don't worry about it. But here's the sitch, Helen. They're doing a scoping study. They're doing a phase one to see if a study is feasible. And we met up with these National Academy of Sciences people, and they said there's been no data kept. The industry has not been keeping data on the health of its workers or the health of the surrounding communities. And so they are really uncertain that they could produce a quality study.
But hasn't the state got a health department that would, that forget about the Southern Georgia Company, they're not going to look at the surrounding population and see if they're getting cancer from the nuclear reactors. But isn't there a health commission or health project within the state government of Georgia who collects statistics on cancer incidents and other diseases? Isn't there? There must be.
Well, like I said, there's this general registry, and that just keeps like who died, you know, how many babies died. That sort of data is kept, I guess, kind of as almost like census data. So that data has been analyzed, but no, there's not been any special studies done to keep tabs on the communities that live, you know, in close proximity to the reactors.
So these people are guinea pigs. They're being killed. I mean, I would state,
I would state
that outright as a physician and a pediatrician. If they're not collecting data, that there's anecdotal evidence that, that most families have experienced a higher than normal incidence of cancer, it's right next to the reactor. And no one's looking at it. This, I mean, it absolutely takes my breath away as a physician. How can even the medical, the AMA, American Medical Association in Georgia, countenance such activity? I just, it's beyond the scope of my imagination, Glenn Carroll.
It's terrible. And as you know, because you've been so active in this issue and you have an edge on us because you're an MD, but it's a slippery slope to talk about health. And yet because so many of the scientists have not paid attention to this, and you get, you know, your Dr. John Goffman, and you get your Casey Morgan, and your Alice Stewart, but they are few, and your Rosalie Bertel, and you. And there's just so many more physicians ignoring it altogether, treating cancer instead of preventing it.
Okay, now the next question I have is, I hear that until 10 years ago, I think, the EPA, I think, Environmental Protection Agency, was studying the food and the water in Shell Bluff and in Burke County for radiation, and they stopped doing that. Can you fill us in on that, please, Glenn Carroll?
Okay, now it's not the greatest, but what happened was, you know, as I mentioned before, the Savannah River site, which is the second largest nuclear weapons reservation in the country after Hanford in Washington, is right across the river, and it's been operating since 1950, and as you know, it operated in secrecy until the late 80s when, you know, we tried to paste on some environmental oversight, but it was really an environmental disaster over there, and it's still a problem. And it was the early 90s, and tritium was found in residential wells in Burke County. But it was thought, and the whole program was related to Savannah River site, that the tritium was from there. And Department of Energy, which sounds like it would be making electricity, but it actually does a whole lot more bomb making in our country, gave a grant to the state of Georgia to the tune of about $700,000 a year to monitor five counties, the food, the water, the fish, the soil, the air, the plants, the deer, the milk. And but they were really, it was really, you know, oriented towards Savannah River site. And this was administered by our Georgia Environmental Protection Division. And I'm losing track of the time now because, like you said, it's been over 10 years ago, about 10 years ago that it lapsed. And it actually lapsed because our first Republican governor in the history of Georgia did not reapply. And several groups, including Georgia Wand, which you, of course, founded Wand, have really pushed hard to reinstate this monitoring. And it's quite a saga of promises and broken promises, and even the latest promise that came from the deputy director of the Department of Energy. She has been fired, and her job hasn't even been, her position hasn't even been filled. So we just have been in limbo for a long time. And we are whispering louder now that we really think the reason they did stop the monitoring was because of Southern Company's and Georgia Power's plans to build two new reactors. You know, we just found tritium there. We're finding tritium everywhere we look in this country. And they just did not need the enhanced scrutiny.
All right.
And, you know, going back to that meeting last week, I watched those guys with a straight face tell us that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's data that they keep on all the reactors in the country are the data that's submitted by the licensees, by the utilities that run those things. And it's just a joke to think that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission can go in and find out if they're falsifying data. I would expect that the data is false. Terrible situation. I'm getting mad all over again.
Well, let me tell the audience what tritium is. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen. It's H3 instead of H2. And the nuclear industry will say, don't worry, it's only just radioactive hydrogen. Now, they say that, but in fact, they're very scared of tritium. And if you go to the Journal of Health Physics, which is the journal of the nuclear industry, you'll find in the early 1990s and on, a large body of literature on tritium. They have injected it into rats, into mice, and they have looked at all sorts of abnormalities induced by tritium. It only produces beta radiation, which is an electron given off from the atom, but it's very damaging to genes. So it's very carcinogenic and can cause cancer in any organ. It also causes a very bad fetal abnormality, so the baby rats and mice are born grossly deformed. It also damages genes in the eggs and sperm, which are passed on generation to generation to cause genetic disease in the future. And so it's very, very dangerous stuff. Now, tritium, of course, combines with oxygen to form H3O or tritiated water. So if you're immersed in a fog near a nuclear power plant which is emitting tritium, or near the Savannah River site just near Shell Bluff in Burke County, the tritiated water in the fog is absorbed straight through your skin. Tritium also enters the body by inhalation through the lung and by ingestion through the gut. It is bioconcentrated in the food chain, so the food becomes radioactive. Trees become radioactive. Tritiated water drops from the leaves of trees at night onto the ground. Tritium is such a tiny little molecule that it escapes from everything. The only thing that prevents its release is gold, because gold is so dense. So therefore you can't prevent tritium escaping. And a lot of tritium is made in nuclear power plants, including Vogtle 1 and 2. And they've had power plants, or no, reactors at Savannah River and the like, and so tritium escapes from there. And it's ubiquitous. It's hardly ever mentioned. It's extremely biologically dangerous. And so that's one of the problems. The other problem is the Savannah River site, where I visited, actually is very near Burke County and these Vogtle reactors and the very poor African-American community. And Savannah Riverside is just like descending into Hades. It's just unbelievable, with huge tanks of hot radioactive waste, many of them. Plutonium is buried in the soil there and is leaking. It leaks into the Savannah River with other isotopes. It's just like being in hell. And so this is a site where not only have they got two reactors there, but Glen Carroll, they've just decided to build two more. Now, I want you to go back, please, and explain to the audience the change in the licensing procedures. I, in fact, wrote about these changes in my latest book on nuclear power called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer. But there were two steps in the licensing process for nuclear reactors, and those licensing requirements have been changed. Can you explain to the audience what they are, please?
Well, in the olden days, we used to get a license to build a reactor. When the reactor was completed, it went through an exhaustive, I don't know how exhaustive it was. I'm pretty cynical, but they went through about a year and a half to 2 year process of analyzing the quality of construction, compared it to the designs. And, of course, one famous case was at Diablo, where they actually built a whole reactor over a 10-year period as a mirror image of its design. Now, that's evil. But that came under scrutiny, you see, because you would look it over before you would give it a license to operate.
So the first license was given to build the reactor,
and then for
construction. The second license was given once the reactor was constructed to make sure it was okay.
Now, I want to, you know, maybe insert here that the failure of the nuclear industry to produce the 1,000 or 2,000 reactors that they envisioned, and they were held at just a few more than 100, we activists were blamed that we got in there and we drove up the costs. And, of course, Three Mile Island was blamed because it rightfully brought about some design changes that had to be put in to make things safer, and which haven't been done all that well, but that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was just too strict. And so the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you know, was lobbied to make a change. And so the one change they made in the early 90s was to do this combined operating license,
which is what Vogel was given last week. Yeah, describe it.
One-step licensing. Now, well, it's got another component. It was supposed to be that we would do, historically in this country, every reactor we built is unique. And so that was considered a problem. It was considered that France succeeded with nuclear energy better than we did because they had a couple of designs and they stuck with them and they built them over and over and over again. So General Electric and Westinghouse, and they keep changing their names too, but there's another design out there that's not as prominent as GE and Westinghouse, and it's eluding me right this minute. But they were all supposed to get a license for their design, so that would be done separately. So then when Southern Company thought to build a reactor, they would pick a design that was already licensed. And maybe we'll have time to talk about that, because the Westinghouse AP1000 that Southern Company proposes to build had a license, but they changed their design, I'm convinced, to reduce costs. And part of that design is actually doing away with the containment building. So maybe we'll come back to that, because buildings are pretty important. That's what we watched blow up at Fukushima, and they're actually talking about building reactors that don't have containment domes. So anyway, that got kind of complicated because Westinghouse, went back and went through like 19 revisions before they got their license, which happened right before Christmas. They also got another step, which I think is going to be hard to live with, and it's called an early site permit. And they were trying to remove the uncertainty that utilities were experiencing, that they were blaming for cost overruns. So Southern Company was a leader in this. They were the first utility to test this new regulation. And they did achieve their early site permit. And what that does is that lets them go through all the environmental scrutiny for the site and bank. That license is good for 20 years. So even if something happens, like Southern Company is also depending on federal loan guarantees in addition to this QIP money that they shook us down for, they're depending on $8.3 billion of tax-funded loan guarantees, which, by the way, is not still going to make a pile of money big enough to finish this reactor project. But if something happens to interrupt their flow, they could still come back and restart this project, you know, up to 20 years.
How do you
mean? Now, we're having a historic drought. We've got more and more draw on the Savannah River. You know, it's just crazy to think that we can really anticipate how the world's going to be in 20 years, and yet that is what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has put out there. So those are three basic changes.
I don't understand, Glenn. Something happens to interrupt their flow. Flow of what? Flow of money? Flow of water? What are you talking about?
Well, their flow of, you know, forging ahead with the project. And right now, our greatest hope lies with stopping the loan guarantees. It was much talked about that Solyndra, the solar company, defaulted on their loan guarantee, which was for $500 million, which is a lot of money, but that's only a fraction of what we're talking about giving to Southern Company. And by the way, Solyndra failed because of the success of solar. It just got in the game too late with the bulky program, and they just were not able to get traction. But that same success with solar is bound to interrupt the success of the nuclear project.
Do the loan guarantees come from the federal government? Is that what you're talking about, or from the state?
That's right. Because of the failure of Solyndra, and this could work in our favor, there is bipartisan pushback saying we've got to hold the phone and figure out what DOE is doing wrong, you know, that they're giving huge sums of money to companies that are failing with their projects. And so right now, it's under an audit has been done. It's been criticized because it really only looks at the success rate of loan guarantees, and the criticism is really not looking at how Department of Energy actually selects the people that it would give money to. But be that as it may, it's right now under White House review. And so we're really hopeful, and we're generating a lot of letters to hopefully get them to sober up and realize, that, listen here, Helen, this is really creepy. They're soaking Georgia ratepayers for $2 billion, $1 billion of that, and this is for the upfront cost. This is to give them enough, a rosy enough financial picture that they will actually qualify for these $8.3 billion in loan guarantees. $1 billion of that is pure profit to give them that 12% profit. Okay, so the whole package is just to make them look great on paper so that they can then borrow money. And remember, it was a Federal Reserve Bank officer that helped arrange all of this as CEO of Southern Company. So then they get the $8.3 billion at 0% or 0.5%. I mean, where can I sign up to borrow money at such an advantageous rate, right? Then they're talking right now that it's going to cost $14.6 billion to do this project. They've got $10 billion lined up. Nothing with the Georgia ratepayers. Oh, and I want to insert here that Southern Company has a very wide market, and for all we know, this power is going to be sold to Texas. So Georgia ratepayers pay for it, but Texas may get the power. Other people point out that by the time they finish it, they'll be dead, so why should they have to be paying for it? Anyway, there's $4 billion they haven't raised yet, and none of these things are conditional, forcing them to complete the project. I think they've just figured out how to make money for nothing, and they can just construct this reactor till the cows come home, shake us down for money. Somewhere down the road, they're going to holler, what about your investments? You don't want to waste your investment. But the tragedy, Helen, is that the world is turning to solar and wind, and solar and wind are supplying our needs, and we're going to miss the boat in Georgia.
All right.
I'm really not that worried this reactor will come online. I think they're very unrealistic if they say that they can bring them online in 5 or 6 years. Since when? Since when has the reactor ever come online that fast?
Yeah. Well, and actually the realistic price of reactors now is is about $12 billion per reactor. So we're looking at more like $20 billion if to be realistic. Now, I want Glenn Carroll, for you to describe what an AP1000 Westinghouse reactor is. It's called an advanced reactor. Why is it advanced? And what are the unique parts of its design that they call it advanced?
Well, it's advanced like white is black and up is down. It is dumbed down. I referred to the fact that they don't have a containment building in the design. Now, a containment building is really important. This was a real key to ever even commercializing nuclear power. As we said early on, that the amount of radioactivity inside a running reactor is fantastic. It's an incredible amount. It's just not the kind of radiation we experience on the surface of the Earth. So the premise is, do not let it out. And so they have something called defense in depth, and they have backups, and the backups have backups, and the backup to the backup has backup. So this is the premise. And the containment building would be 5 feet thick of reinforced steel. Now, we've been practicing, you see, with this reactor technology. So unfortunately, we built a lot of the type of reactor that we saw exploding at Fukushima before we realized that wasn't a very effective containment. But the Vogel reactors we have now have the really large, really robust containment that, you know, is as good as it gets in that business. Now, they're 5 feet thick, they're very roomy, so that when pressures start building in there, it's a really big space, and it just, you know, ideally won't ever get such a high pressure that it could breach a 5 foot thick reinforced concrete shell. They're replacing that with what they call a shield building. It would be 2.5 feet thick, which is half as thick. It's stacked blocks of concrete. Westinghouse calls it Lego style. Now, here's the kicker. It's open at the top, so it's not even sealed like the containment domes. That's why they don't call it containment. It's a shield building. They have said, if there's an accident, this is just to protect the workers a little bit that have to get up close to it. It's open at the top because it's fantastically hot in there, and one of your giant problems with a reactor is to cool it. So they want to have some heat exchange, so it's open at the top. And if you're thinking of a chimney, you've got it. The analysis, which was done by Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds, he's a real treasure. He has really been wonderful educating people after Fukushima, a former insider nuclear engineer. So he did the analysis on problems with this, and he called it the chimney effect. So that's a problem. Now, what they're saying, we know at Fukushima that what happened, and this is a danger at every single reactor, is if you do not keep the pumps working and the water flowing around that reactor, the temperatures are so fantastic that, you know, if you fail to keep it cool, you will have melting fuel, and then you'll have explosions and radioactivity getting out. And we saw the failure of the generators at Fukushima, which contributed to the problems there. Well, what they're really hanging their hat on and bragging about is the million-gallon tank of water, which will sit atop the reactor vessel. Now, keep in mind, this is a 8-million-pound thing. This thing's going to weigh 4 tons. Did I do the math right? I think it's more than that. Maybe it's 4,000 tons. Anyway.
And how big is the tank? How many gallons?
1 million gallons. And this water, if there's an accident, this water is going to trickle out, and it's going to last for 7 days. So for 7 days, trickling water will trickle down over the reactor and keep it cool. Now, of course, on day 8, you're sunk. The problem with that is a couple of things. It's never been tried. It's a theory. And as Arne Gunderson pointed out in his report, which is on our website and on his Fairwinds website and many places, we now have what used to be a sealed environment, and it's called a reduced environment, and it's dry and oxygen is not in there. Well, now we've got a moist, open environment with oxygen, and there's a real concern about corrosion in the space that the water would trickle down. So those are a couple of the problems. And then one problem that actually inspired an engineer, a woman, with Westinghouse to blow the whistle is that they originally planned a 600-megawatt reactor, and that was the original design. And now they've scaled it up to suit industrial needs to, Southern Company's desires to a 1,200-megawatt. They've doubled the size of it, but they have not doubled the size of all the components of the reactor. And so she is very concerned that there is a disconnect there and there are safety gaps because it's just not going to work the way they plan.
Well, I talked to Arnie Gunderson the other day about this AP1000 reactor, which is actually an AP1200 reactor, as you just described. And it's got 1 million gallons of water in a tank sitting above it, so that if there is an abnormality in cooling, as you described, the water trickles down and keeps it cool. But because that water, 1 million gallons, is so incredibly heavy, it will destabilize the construction design of the reactor and the actual engineering features to make it much weaker structurally. And he's very concerned about that. That's number one. Number two, apart from the chimney effect that you described, Glenn Carroll, and Arnie Gunderson goes into this very carefully in an article he wrote for the New York Times, which will be on his webpage at fairwinds.com. The company, Westinghouse, has short-circuited the construction materials, and so, as you said, it's that they've saved money by having less concrete in it and less steel, and it's called by some the eggshell reactor, because it will be very vulnerable to accidents and the like. Now, those are the two.
The thing I heard, and it was held up at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and I'm not privy to what made them feel relaxed about letting it go, that if an airplane hit it,
yeah,
or under certain seismic conditions, which,
yeah,
we might want to visit that, it would shatter like a teacup.
That's right, eggshell reactor.
Building.
Teacup reactor. So they're getting $8.3 billion loan guarantee initiated by President Obama, for God's sake.
It was initiated by, the whole program was initiated by Bush, but in his second year in office, Obama certainly disappointed me when he stepped up and announced that Southern Company, and Southern Company, by the way, is the only utility that's actually been named to receive loan guarantees.
That's
There's still
correct.
$10 billion that haven't been dedicated to anybody yet.
This is the first license that has been granted for a nuclear power plant, since 1974, Glenn Carroll?
1978.
First one since 78. Now, what really disappoints me, and I'd just like to say that, is that President Obama is pro-nuclear power. His main advisor is David Axelrod, who worked for Exelon. Another person he's got very close to him is John Rowe, who's the president of Exelon, and Exelon has about 13 reactors in the state of Illinois, the most heavily nuclearized state in America. And also, who's now the mayor of Chicago? Rahm Emanuel worked for Exelon too. And also, Obama received over $250,000 during his first campaign from Exelon. So he's a nuclear power president. I always have thought that if I could spend just half an hour with him alone and talk to him about the medical effects of nuclear power upon children and future generations, that I could convince him to become an anti-nuclear power president, because he's got two little children who he absolutely adores, and he's obviously a man of deep sentiments and emotions and much love for his family. but trying to get to him is almost impossible. As we talk, you know, Glenn Carroll, I can't help feeling the most extraordinary indignation how these people can conduct such evil. And I'm reminded of what Edmund Burke said, that Englishman way back in the 1800s.
That Burke County is named after.
Is that so?
That's right.
Is that
Isn't that crazy?
So?
Say it, Helen. He
said, the only way evil flourishes is for good people to do nothing. I shall repeat that. The only way evil flourishes is for good people to do nothing. Now, the problem we have is, A, can we get there in time before there's another nuclear meltdown like in Indian Point, 35 miles from Manhattan? And these reactors, they'll keep them operating, you know, as long as they possibly can. Or B, India and Pakistan don't go to war with each other and blow up nuclear weapons and cause nuclear autumn and the death of billions. Which is an absolute possibility, because I interviewed a wonderful physicist recently called Pervez Hoodboy from Pakistan, who actually admitted that's a possibility. And can we get the renewables up in time, as you are so optimistically discussing, Glenn Carroll, in order to close down all the reactors, but more, also close down the coal-fired plants, which are inducing global warming as we speak? Can we do it? And I think the key to survival of the planet now is for all of us to rise up, get off our Facebooks, get off our bottoms, get off our couches, and get out there. And I think one of the great things that is occurring really is the Occupy movement. And I think it's time to occupy the NRC. I mean, I really do. The NRC is a sycophant of the nuclear industry, paid for by the nuclear industry, except for its president or chairman, Greg Jasko, and I think that this movement is revolutionary, and it's led by, you know, a lot of the young people who are really gutsy and not afraid of anything.
I agree, and it's intelligent.
And it's intelligent.
And we've also been privileged to hang out some with the coal activists who are enjoying a lot of success and, you know, pushing back on mountaintop removal, and these kids are brilliant, and they're ethical.
Oh, yeah.
And they get the nuclear issue. And, you know, it's really the energy picture. And actually, it's the economy. Because the way the economy works, why wouldn't Southern Company? I mean, let's just step back a minute. The game appears to be legitimate. It hasn't been shut down as being unlawful. People aren't going to jail. Wall Street bankers aren't going to jail. The way this game works, there's big profits to be made if you're lucky enough to get in the high-stakes nuclear poker game. That big money is not there for solar and wind. And so us dedicated activists can sit there all day long and say it will be cheaper and more efficient, but cheaper and more efficient does not translate into profits for these big corporations.
Yeah.
So really, the Occupy movement, you know, bringing, and you know what, Helen, I don't know about you, but everywhere I go, and people aren't going down there necessarily, and they might not want to align themselves with Occupy, but all my neighbors, everybody I know, they get it, that something's really sick and
wrong.
Well,
what about, okay, so Glenn, we're about to finish, but what about occupying the Southern Company? I'll come and do it with you.
Well, our friends over at WAND weren't even allowed to come into the press conference the other day.
No, I don't mean that. I mean Occupy.
Occupy, sure, you got your bail money.
Occupy the building. Their stupid conferences are orchestrated so you don't get a word in edgeways, and there are policemen there. I mean,
hey,
occupy the building.
Meeting every May, buy a share of Southern Company stock and come to the shareholder meeting, and we'll mic check them.
Occupy it, mic check. I actually spoke to Cotty Park twice, and I love the mic check. Let me just describe that, and we'll finish the interview. But anyway, you stand up before this sort of unruly mob of people. There are dogs, babies, men in pinstripe suits, women in fur coats, you know, the whole schmeal of society. And I stand up, and someone stands beside me, and someone yells out, mic check. And everyone says, mic check. And then I say, Indian Point is 35 miles from Manhattan. And the person...
Indian Point is 35 miles from Manhattan.
Yeah, the person next to me repeats that, and then it goes back into the crowd, and then the crowd repeats it. Indian Point is 35 miles from Manhattan. And as they repeat it twice, they, because they're saying it themselves, they take it into their brains and they really hear it. And then I say, if there was a meltdown at Indian Point, you know, millions could die in New York. If there's a meltdown in Indian Point, millions could die in New York. And so it's a very powerful way. And in fact, they're taking over like the shareholders meeting at Southern Company. And you do mic check and it absolutely phases everyone out because they can't stop it because the whole crowd is repeating what
it
said.
Well, the thing is people love it. The people that hear it,
yeah.
It's just kind of magic.
Yeah.
Now, Helen, you hit on Indian Point a couple of times. And I want to say something else positive. Vermont Yankee could shut in March. Indian Point has none other than the state of New York trying to stop it from getting a license extension.
Yes, I know that.
And you're in California where it's progressive. You have a moratorium on new reactors. You've shut more than one reactor. There is hope, actually, to roll back old reactors, I think. And that's not happening here in Georgia, so I get discouraged being the only state where we've got two new reactors and we've got this horrible monopoly that owns the legislature and the Public Service Commission. But, worldwide, there's tens of thousands of people in the streets in Japan. There's thousands of people, and they're getting hurt in India. But they're pushing back on reactors under construction in India. So sometimes we have to remember we're not even the only country on Earth.
And oh, yes, that's a very important thing for Americans to remember.
Activism in other countries.
You are not the only country on Earth. Anyway, look, on that really happy, optimistic, exciting note, Glenn Carroll, I thank you very, very much for this interview. It's been fascinating. I hope everyone listens and actually gets out and puts their body on the line in Occupy Southern Company, in Occupy the NRC, in Occupy your State House, in Occupy the Congress. Let's go for it when the weather warms up. Thank you very much, Glenn Carroll.
It's been great talking with you, Helen.
Okay, lovey.
See you later.
Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been speaking with Glenn Carroll, a visual artist and a coordinator of Nuclear Watch South in Atlanta, Georgia. All right, well, that's it for today. If you want to contribute to this wonderful radio program, although I say it myself as shouldn't, as my mother would have said, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org and there is a place to donate money. I'd be very grateful. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.